The new year is here, and it's the perfect time to kickstart your meditation practice. The Morning Meditation for Women podcast has short, daily guided meditations that will help you start your day with intention and focus, and make it so easy to get you into the habit. Imagine feeling so much more calm and confident in 2025. Follow and listen to Morning Meditation for Women on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Annie Fry Show.
And welcome back. I'm Ryan Recker, filling in for Annie Fry. We're getting so close to the new year. Happy New Year to you and your family. Joining us now is a fentanyl expert, also former White House homelessness czar. We're going to talk to him about both of those things. Dr. Robert Marbit, thank you so much for joining us in St. Louis today.
Thank you so much for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, I don't know where to start first. So let's start homelessness, because St. Louis has had problems, and I've had conversations with people that have really dedicated a lot of their adult life to try to help homelessness in cities like St. Louis. And what you find are a couple of common problems along other cities. And you see fentanyl being a part of that, because people get their certain addictions or whatever it may be, and it changes their life, and drugs change people's lives, and sometimes circumstances that have nothing to do with them. They did nothing. You know, they could have had a great paying job, and next thing you know, it's just one loss of a job and you're out on the streets. And there's so much that you can find these topics intertwined. When you were working homelessness on a national scale and you were kind of one of the national czars on it, what was your approach? How do you approach homelessness in America?
Well, the most important thing you have to do is understand the problem in the first place. And if you look at what's going on in the streets, and I've been to St. Louis probably dozens of times, and what you see on the street is untreated mental illness with co-presenting substance abuse. It's not really recreational drug use. It's self-medicating drug use for the most part. There's a small 7, 8, 9% recreational use, but for the most part, they just find the cheapest drug available to try to numb their conditions. And so you can't address homelessness unless you address substance use and, candidly, the fentanyl issue, because fentanyl has become the cheapest drug on the street in most places in America now.
Yeah, and I did a late night talk show, and I would talk to people who were homeless. They had phones, and sometimes they would just be staying with someone else, or they would call in and talk about their experiences. And one thing I remember a person telling me is they feel safer on the street than they do some of the shelters, because they're understaffed, and they find that there's so much drug use in these shelters in the shadows or the stairways or whatever it is that they don't feel safe around them. So if they're trying to stay clean, they find their best option is to be out on the streets, where at least they know they can be alone and not around that sort of thing. I'm sure you've heard stories like that.
And that really changed in 2012 when the federal government told agencies like nonprofit, like Salvation Army, Rescue Mission, Haven for Hope, and Alvin Chapman Center, what have you. The federal government said, if you're going to receive federal government money, you can no longer have requirements inside your facility. So you can't have a clean and sober shelter. You can't have safety and security. You can't have rules and requirements. You can't say you have to go to class, you have to go to treatment, you have to go to recovery. And it totally messed the system up. And think about this. If you get a federal Pell Grant, we require you to attend class. Most places, it's you have to have at least an 88.5% attendance. You have to have at least a C grade. You have to finish in a certain period of time. We do that with unemployment insurance. We do it with TANF. We do it with Pell Grants. But when it comes to the welfare system connected to homelessness, we said we're just going to give you vouchers. We're going to give you free gas cards, food cards, et cetera, but have no requirements for treatment and recovery. And it just makes no sense. And it just, when the federal government made that change in 2012 under the Obama-Biden administration, it just totally tied the hands of agencies who want to focus on treatment and recovery to help get you out of homelessness forever.
Wow. You know, there's an advocate that has spent most of his life helping and advocating for the homeless here in St. Louis. His name's Larry Rice, and he does it with a faith-based side of it. He's run a shelter for, 40 years? It's been a long time. But he's done it in a way where he hasn't had to accept government funding for it because he wants to have that, you know, we'll bring you in, but we're going to put you in front of God, too. We want to be able to help you spiritually as well. And it was a very successful thing. And he told me something changed right around the time you're talking about it. He said that all of a sudden the government fought him, as in they wanted to make sure he, as an independent person that was running this as a ministry through his church, made it as hard as possible for him to have a homeless shelter. And they harassed him so much to the point where it's like litigation after litigation just to try to reopen the shelter. And something else, I'll tell you, it made some national news. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but every night they would go around and people with his church would try to find homeless people on the street, one, to check in on them to make sure they're still alive and, you know, they need anything. But the other thing was to hand them food. Well, they were ticketed by the city. Police gave them tickets because they didn't have a proper food handling license to give sandwiches to the homeless. So they ended up fighting that one in court, too. But you probably have seen some cities, in St. Louis included, that they do everything they can to make independent help of the homeless as hard as possible.
And that repeats itself over and over around the country. And we've made it very hard for the faith-based community to do what they know how to do well, which is to get people through treatment and recovery. And think about this. The homelessness really started in America shortly after the Civil War. The federal government did not get into the homelessness business until the Reagan administration, so 1987-ish is when the federal government formally got into the homelessness recovery business. But faith community, the Salvation Army, back then the Red Cross, the rescue missions, all started shortly after the Civil War and helped in the world of homeless for 120 years. And by the way, our problem was much better handled by them. And then the federal government came in and said, we're with the federal government. We know more and we can help you. It's the old Ronald Reagan, you know, nothing more scary than somebody in a suit says, I'm with the federal government and I'm here to help you. And it really did change things. And it made it where you couldn't do what you knew worked. And what we know works is treatment, recovery, allowing the faith community when they want. That's not the only solution, but you have to allow the faith community to come in and do what they know works. Let the secular community come in too when they want to, and focus on programming. And all I know is if you're experiencing homelessness and we make it easy for you to take drugs, we don't put you into treatment programs. We don't put you into job training. We don't put you into job readiness. Why in the world would you expect recovery to happen if we make it much easier to get high and harder to get treatment? My mantra is we need to make it easy to get treatment, hard to get high.
That's the problem nationwide. There's such it's like a cult-like thinking in a way when you have this legalization of marijuana in such a grand scale where it becomes so readily available to people. And part of what we see too, and you know, I'm up in Detroit now and I get opportunities to luckily do shows here in St. Louis where I'm very familiar with it. But you talk to superintendents in schools and they talk about these kids getting a hold of their parents' gummies and things because they look like candy, or they'll bring it into school and share it. And they're saying there's an epidemic of sharing these drugs in schools right now. And I keep thinking, we're glorifying this stuff on a national scale. We're legalizing it and making it easily inaccessible. And what kind of problems is that going to bring when people are celebrating that?
Well, let's not just talk weed and marijuana. If you go from L.A. all the way to Seattle and parts of Hawaii, parts of Chicago, a few other places around the country, Philadelphia had this problem. where they were either totally legalizing hard drugs or not prosecuting hard drugs, literally not prosecuting fentanyl use. And in San Francisco, you had the health department actually creating a site where you could go use fentanyl. It's not just low-end drugs, it's high-end drugs. And if you do that, it's not a wonder to me we have the death rate we have. I don't think it's a surprise at all when you totally legalize the high-end drugs and said we're going to stop prosecuting it.
Yeah, and it's such a weird position to be in because you're looked at as the bad guy when you advocate against these things because they say, oh, you're just not with it, right? It's, you got to get with the times, old man. Those things have changed from now on. Like everything's got to be this party and you just have to go along with it no matter if it's destroying people's lives. And that's what drives me crazy about all of this too, is that we're watching things spiral out of control in real time and people are still on that side.
Let me give you one stat, and this is when I heard this stat and processed it, is when I said, that's when I went and started the movie Fentanyl Death Incorporated. Here's the stat. More people have died from fentanyl only, not any of the other drugs, just fentanyl in America in the last 5 years than all men and women in the American seven branches of armed services, plus the intelligence agencies for the last 100 years. So World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, global war on terror, Gulf War I, Gulf War II, UN. Add all those fatalities up of Americans. More people have died with fentanyl in the last 5 years in the United States.
Oh, wow.
Think about that, number.
Else.
And we've legalized it. We said it's okay to do it. It has the highest death rate that we've ever had. Drugs are not what they were in the 1960s. Fentanyl is the most lethal, deadly drug ever created on planet Earth. And you have parts of America saying, let's legalize it. Let's not prosecute it. In fact, let's have the health department provide your straws and your foil and your pipes. It makes no sense in my mind at all. We've lost the common sense.
Yeah, you have seen that. You've seen where, in California in particular, it's government-sanctioned crack pipes. And this is part of it, too. Before, you would read the official documents of what they were going to provide to people, and you would bring it up, and you were called a conspiracy theorist. There's no way a government agency will ever do that, but we're at the point where they say, well, we need to, number one, be compassionate and understand their problems. So this is our way of reaching them. At least we can get in front of them that way. And the other thing they argue is that if they're getting it from us, we at least know it's clean, the syringes, the things like that. So this may actually help prevent further outbreaks. If they're getting clean stuff from us, we know they're going to use anyway. And that drives me crazy, too, that we're using taxpayer money and we're using our dollars and resources to fund drug habits.
And that assumes, you know, what you, and I totally agree with you 100%, and what the other side is saying is we can make fentanyl safe to consume, and we can make the supply of fentanyl safe for the consumer. You cannot make fentanyl safe. 2 to 3 grains equivalent of salt will kill you. 1/15 of a rice grain of fentanyl will kill you. You can't make something that lethal safe. But the other side is saying, oh, let's provide it for you. Let's give you an environment to do it. And why is the death rate skyrocketed? Because we're making it, so easy to get high. And we should be spending our money and time and government taxpayers helping you get into recovery, help you beating the habit, and help you get a job. That's what we know works. Instead of saying, let's have, right now in America, if you have a severe drug habit, you jump in front of the line to get housing vouchers faster. Now, not slower, faster. And we wonder why the death rate is doubled in California and most of the West Coast. And it's because people are going into these federally subsidized housing rooms and getting high and dying. It makes no sense at any level of common sense.
Yeah, what you find in going back to the faith based organizations. A lot of times they prioritize women and children who are trying to escape a situation. So they're looked at as, okay, this is vulnerable and we want to help that child. So we're going to help that person get out. But you don't see the prioritization. What you find is that they just don't care. In a lot of ways, they would rather give you a voucher than help you. But let's look at this too. What do you do with the ones that don't want help? You find that they don't have the drive. They don't really have the need they see. They're perfectly content with being homeless and taking drugs, and they just don't want to be helped. What do you do in situations like that?
Well, the good news, and I know this number both from what I did when I was in the White House and what I did it on the streets as a consultant. In most communities, that number is a little below 20%. There's a handful of communities that gets into the, you know, high 20s, 28-29%. But that still means 2/3 to 3/4 of the people want help and treatment. So let's focus on the people who want help, want treatment. Let's get them into the program. When you finish working through all of that group, then you can focus on the recalcitrant group or the shelter resistant or treatment resistant. And the great news is the Supreme Court has a new ruling called City of Grants Pass versus Johnson. It came out just last July. And before, your police departments, where hands were tied, they couldn't do anything with that recalcitrant group, that resistant group. Now they can. And so we now have tools to do it. And so we should focus on doing that. But let's start first with all the people who want help and can't get it, because in San Francisco, they spend all their money making it easy to take drugs, and they have very little treatment programs. They've actually been reducing their treatment and providing more what's called safe consumption sites. Some parts in America is called safe injection sites. And mm-hmm. we just got it totally backwards. And let's not make it a right-wing or left-wing thing. Let's make this a common-sense approach.
You are a fentanyl national expert. You are also a senior producer on a new documentary called Fentanyl Death Incorporated. Do you mind holding on after the break? I'd love to talk to you more about this documentary and the things you cover in it.
Absolutely.
Dr. Robert Marbit, you can find him online if you do a search, but look for Fentanyl Death Incorporated if you want to learn about the most comprehensive documentary ever produced on the fentanyl crisis, and boy, does it apply to the streets of St. Louis. I'm Ryan Recker, filling in for Annie Fry. Don't go anywhere on 97.1 FM Talk.
The music, the memories, and keep them inside you.
And welcome back. I'm Ryan Recker, filling in. And there's a documentary called Fentanyl Death Incorporated. Their senior producer, Dr. Robert Marbit, is someone that not only knows about fentanyl drugs, but homelessness. And he's someone that worked in the White House with the White House. Dr. Marbit, thank you so much for spending so much time with us here in St. Louis. And Happy New Year to you, by the way.
And Happy New Year to you. And thanks so much for focusing on this topic that, to me, there's no greater threat to America than the fentanyl crisis that we're facing. Just full stop, period.
Let's talk about some of the aspects to it, and I guess we can start where fentanyl comes from. So you heard a lot about it coming up from Mexico, maybe funneled from China. Where does fentanyl even come from?
So let's talk about the first phase of fentanyl that hit about 10 years ago. You had Purdue Pharma in America and many other synthetic manufacturers of opioids. So we've jumped from organic opioids to synthetic. They were used, given for people post-surgical, and they got millions of people into prescriptions, hundreds of thousands addicted, and the docs through the Purdue Pharma and other producers said this was non-addictive or not nearly as addictive. Well, it turned out, as we all know the story, it was very, very addictive, totally opposite to what they're told. So suddenly, with all the lawsuits, people could no longer get prescription, but they're now addicted. So we got a phase of people, hundreds of thousands, millions of people addicted. And the Mexican cartels, they are horrible people doing horrible things, but you got to give them an understanding that they're good at business. They already were doing all sorts of distribution of illicit drugs throughout America. They knew how to get drugs across the border. So they jumped in and they worked with the Chinese manufacturers and started bringing illicit fentanyl in through their normal distribution channels. And that was phase one of it, was working the Mexican cartels, working with China to backfill the supply that got caused by the Purdue Pharma crisis. So that's phase one. We're now into about phase three, where cartels in Mexico are bringing it in directly. But what's scarier, we now have biker gangs up in Canada backfilling the Mexican supply chain. And so we now have fentanyl coming across the northern border. And that's why President Trump got so upset with Canada, and Premier Trudeau, Prime Minister of Canada, flew down to talk to him, because President-elect Trump said, you guys got to stop bringing it in from Canada too and allowing it to come across the border.
Wow. I've never ever considered Canadian biker gangs a thing until right now. But going back to Donald Trump's first 4 years in office, there was a push to try to stop the flow of fentanyl. It was partially part of the immigration discussion, but also part of it was toughening the laws. And, you know, I remember it was kind of controversial at the time, but it was a good idea. If you are caught with this stuff and you distributed it to someone that died, you can be charged with their death. And it was going hard on trying to criminalize those that are distributing the fentanyl in the United States. Now, fast forward to Joe Biden. I don't think I ever heard him once mention stopping fentanyl coming in from anywhere. So do you think this will be a priority again with the second term of Donald Trump? And do you think something can be done?
It is. First off, I'm excited that President Trump's already starting to put some great people in place on it. But most importantly, he's focused on it. Think about this. The biggest drug bust that's ever happened in Canada occurred after he was elected. We've had two major drug busts of cartels down in Mexico. Since he started talking about it, he's had the Prime Minister of Canada call him up and come down and see him in Mar-a-Lago. He's had the president of Mexico call him up and start talking about it and take action. So I'm excited we're putting all the right people in place to finally take care of this. And President Trump dealt with this in his first administration. Then the next administration of Biden and Harris, I don't know what they did for 4 years. I only remember one time him even bringing it up, and it was like they were sort of asleep at the wheel and just totally asleep. Our house is on fire, and they're not acting like it. They're not calling the firefighters. They're not dealing with this crisis. And President-elect Trump is already dealing with it, and it's exciting. So I'm optimistic. We have to start by recriminalizing hard drugs, and wholesalers and major distributors should be held responsible for deaths of people who die with their distribution. Because we know if you pass fentanyl on, people are going to die. We know that. That's just a proven fact. So why don't we treat that the same way you do with a gun or a knife, or just poisoning somebody with strychnine or arsenic? We should treat it the same way.
Yeah, it's so interesting, because if you're hyper paying attention to this topic like you are, and you can only think of one time in the past 4 years that the Biden administration even mentioned this, let alone do anything about it. If the action is null and void, I mean, it's just ignoring the southern border and everything that comes along with what's being passed through that and illegal immigration, kind of in a way that Donald Trump tied it together and saying that we have to know what's coming in through our borders, let it be people or let it be drugs. Now to see it get priority again, that is an important thing, because when you do have someone that actually cares about people dying from these drugs, that makes a huge difference, I think, in American people's lives, because, you know, families are getting ruined by this stuff. They have a kid that starts taking it, and they now have to plan the child's funeral. And what that does to just any one given family, let alone multiply that by the amount of users that we have across the United States. So maybe there is some optimism in the future. Is there even any way to stop it at this point, or is it just trying to minimize its effects?
Well, I think you can, and I'll give you two factoids to think about this. China totally understands how deadly fentanyl is, and there's almost no fentanyl use in the streets of China. And I spent 3 weeks prepping for this movie, going over to China. I went to big cities, small cities, huge areas, back alleys. I went everywhere. And you just don't see any drugs. The entire 3 weeks was there. I saw four people on different drugs. Two were alcohol, one was meth, and one was fentanyl. That was it. Last time I was in St. Louis, last time I was in San Francisco, walked out of the hotel, there were people right on that street, like tens in Seattle, hundreds in San Francisco, who were on fentanyl. And you know fentanyl users because they have what's called the fentanyl bend. They're bent over, and they look like they're asleep, standing up, but they're bent over. It's called a fentanyl bend because what fentanyl does is gives you paralysis of your chest cavity. So you stop breathing, and your heart stops pumping. That's how you die from fentanyl. It gives you a paralysis of your chest cavity. And we have to act like that. And the death rate is so, and more people will die in fentanyl this year than all of Vietnam and Korea combined in 1 year. And we're not acting like that. But that's what's so good about President Trump. He gets this problem. And our friends in the middle, our friends in the left, need to understand you can't talk about the fentanyl crisis without talking about open borders. And you can't have a sovereign country unless you know who's coming across and what they're bringing. That's the first job of a sovereign country, is protecting your country and knowing who's coming in and what are they bringing with them.
Wow. And, you know, the documentary streaming soon, I mean, within the next couple of weeks, but the trailer's up online, Fentanyl Death Incorporated. If people wanted to check out your work, where can they go?
They can go to fentanyldeathincorporated.com. They can see a streaming version on a computer through salemnow.com, like the city spelling now, like immediately now. So salemnow.com. You can do that. And then we're going to Warner Brothers picked it up. It's going to be in what's called a theatrical release in the movie theaters in February, March. And then it will be streaming all over the place by probably late April. So there are a lot of places you can go see it right now if you want to.
Oh, that's amazing. So when you start to do all the research, It's I guess, sometimes hard not to get emotional. It's got to be frustrating for you because you see the manipulation that happens. You see the way that it's politicized, and you see that some people care about it, some people don't. And it's this thing that's killing so many Americans, and it's just ruining lives. It's ruining families. It's ruining communities. This has to be just maddening for you to see the things you're seeing.
And it's so sad. As part of our movie, we talked to a lot of family survivors who have had members die, and to see what they're going through. And 4 years ago, I probably knew a couple families who'd gone through a death of a fentanyl addict. Now, almost every meeting I'm in, every place I go to at church or talk to somebody, or even business meetings about the movie, somebody starts before the meeting, you know, the business part of the meeting starts, that says, let me tell you what happened to my son, my daughter, my niece, my nephew, my sister, my brother. A couple of weeks ago, I was with the person who had parents die of fentanyl. And so it's now so pervasive. And in the last 4 years, so many people are dying now. I don't think you're going to go more than a second or third degree of separation before you find somebody who's died and gone through that tragic loss of a fentanyl death.
What do you think about the bandage of this Narcan and these shots or the things you put into the nose spray? And they say that, well, this is how you combat it. Everyone has to carry Narcan from here on out, and that'll be the magical thing that solves fentanyl?
Let me clearly state, Narcan is not the answer to the drug addiction of fentanyl. Yes, it's a tool that will help save you right this second. But I now know people who've been hit by Narcan with fentanyl overdose 20 or 30 times, and it's like their brain is so damaged. Think about it. If you have a person with a heart attack or stroke, first thing we worry about is how long did they go without oxygen? How long did they go without a pulse? And we know if you go more than 2 or 3 minutes, it starts to damage your brain. That's what happens with a fentanyl overdose, is you stop breathing, you stop pumping blood, and so your brain oxygen starves. And so if we keep hitting you with Narcan after you've gone 2 or 3 minutes without breathing and oxygen to your brain, there's going to be brain damage. And so there's this myth that's been created on the left that Narcan's going to solve this. It will not solve this. It is a tool in the medical process to keep you alive. But if you don't, after you've been hit by Narcan, immediately go into treatment and a recovery program, you're just going to become a vegetable state with brain damage. That's what's happening on the street. And so Narcan's a tool, but it is not the solution to the fentanyl crisis.
Wow. And that's what you hear, too, about first responders that know these people by a first name basis because they're responding over and over and over to these overdoses, and they're using Narcan, and it's like becoming a common occurrence. They're using the resources to go out there, get them jabbed up, and then they'll say, okay, see you next time. And they just know that they're going to get called again for the same person. It's a vicious type of cycle we see in resources being used for it. But you know, I want to make sure people, again, know about your documentary, Fentanyl Death Incorporated. You get the distribution that's going to be rolling out here soon, but people can go online and look for it now and start bookmarking it and, you know, looking for their local theaters and finding things like that. Again, what's the website?
So the website is fentanyldeathincorporated.com. And right now you can, on Salem Now, go to a computer release streaming of it. And then in the end of the first quarter of 2025, you'll start to see it in some theaters, and then it will start streaming nationally.
Wow. It sounds like a very powerful documentary. Are you going to be working with Donald Trump at all in the next administration to help him with homelessness and fentanyl?
Well, it'd be an honor to work with Donald Trump again. If they ask me, I will definitely be saying yes. And it was an honor to work for him in the first administration because he really gets things done. And on fentanyl is a crisis that we're in the middle of in the border. And he's absolutely serious about it. And it's exciting what 2025 is going to look like.
I got to say, it's New Year's Eve. We just did, 35-minute conversation, and I feel like I can go for another 5 hours because it's, to me, you are the authority source to helping people understand this. I hope that he does give you a call because I think you can help a lot of people with your knowledge. Dr. Robert Marbit, thank you so much for joining us here in St. Louis, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, and most importantly, thank you for caring about the fentanyl crisis. Really appreciate it.
I hope there's a resurgence in people caring. I mean, they did for a long period of time, and then it just kind of fell off a cliff with Joe Biden. And I hope that we do get that same fire back in us to try to battle and push this back away, because it is very dangerous, and it's not getting any less dangerous. I really hope. Fentanyl Death Incorporated, that's the name of the documentary. You can look it up online. And Dr. Robert Marbit was our guest the last couple of segments. I got to tell you, that was really, really good. If you listened to this and enjoyed it, you can use the Odyssey app to rewind and even send the link to someone to listen to it. I'm Ryan Recker, filling in for Annie Fry on 97.1 FM Talk. Don't go anywhere.
There must be some kind of way out of here.
Oh boy. Got to tell you, I never considered Canadian biker gangs to be an entity when it comes to trafficking fentanyl into the United States, but it makes sense, as Dr. Robert Marbit, who joined us for two segments there. I got to tell you, what I could have continued that conversation all day, and I'm looking forward to that documentary. And I also never really considered that during the Biden administration, I knew from my own observations, I don't remember him bringing it up, but he is someone that is hyper-focused on fentanyl. And he said in the last 4 years, it was brought up as an off comment once and never addressed ever. That is a very damaging statistic when it comes to priorities in the Biden administration.
Aren't the Hells Angels, aren't they Canadian?
No way. I learned something new. Is that true?
It might be. I don't know. I have to fact check that one.
Are you just making things up on the fly?
No, I'm pretty sure. That's what I heard.
All right. That's what I heard.
they got deep roots in Canada.
Who did you hear this from? Are you part of the biker gang community?
I'm not. I'm not.
Look it up now. And before we go to break here at the top of the hour, I need an answer.
I got you.
But first, while you search that, I wanted to go down some of the big topics that people are talking about. And I don't know if you saw this headline, the polar vortex is ready to hit the U.S. again. And I'm looking at their map right now, what could be happening in the next 2 weeks. And it's going to get cold in pretty much all of Missouri, including here in St. Louis. It's not going to get super duper below average cold, I should say. And this is relative to what you're used to. In areas that are a little bit west of Missouri, so Kansas and further west, there's some areas that are going to see actually above average temperatures, but you're going to find a lot of the Midwest in the south, even down to Florida. Some bitterly cold temperatures are on our way, this polar vortex. Another thing I found too, scientists ruthlessly imaginative 1925 predictions for the future are now starting to come true. And at the end of the year, they always do this, hey, let's revise and look back at this past year. Here's the big news stories. Here's that. But one of the other things that they do that I really enjoy is when they will look at old articles written 100 years ago, and then they'll go through their predictions of the future. So in this case, in 1925, here are some of the predictions that were published regarding the future. They predicted that home loudspeakers and a television machine would replace the picture paper or newspapers for information and on-demand entertainment. I will say that the television is not necessarily replacing it. It's more like the tablets, the screens, the phones. But I think they get the right idea. I don't know if they could have imagined.
Uh-oh, Ryan, you cut out.
Moving pavements and stairs, essentially the escalators and travelers of today, as well as the automatic telephones, which the benefit of getting the right number every time. Some outlandish ideas include illuminating streets by herbs, jets of electronically charged water to replace the cavalry, and mind-to-mind electric communication. Now, that's an interesting one. We're soon to get the mental brain chips put in. I guess that would be a little bit further off, but some people already want these chips put in their brain. Others, they said, such as women in trousers becoming the norm in 1924, and sex determination before birth. They said by 1926, they thought that would happen in 100 years. So I guess they couldn't foresee, you know, back in the day, you didn't know if you're having a boy or a girl until it was out. And now they have other ways to predict it, of course, with the ultrasounds, which is pretty amazing. That's something that, you know, is in the last 40 years, I guess. So maybe science got that a little bit quicker. All right. Did you look up the biker gangs?
Yeah. So apparently their origin is in California, but they did establish a chapter in Quebec in the 70s.
Oh, so they had chapters. They were international.
Yeah. There you go. Canadian biker gang.
I know. Did they message you immediately to correct the record? And are you going to be looking left and right when you leave the building? Because they don't like it when you get the wrong heritage assigned to them in their history.
Well, I wasn't completely wrong, but, you know.
No. Quebec. I can't see. I guess times were different back then. You know, they have quite a history. What was it, the Rolling Stones concert that was an infamous moment for them? And they were at Altamont and... What was it? They killed someone there at the Rolling Stones concert? I'm trying to remember. But there was a big controversy with that one. Would you, let's say the biker gang was on your side. Like, would you be happy to fight alongside them? Or can you think of another group that you would want, like, if you were trying to come up with some sort of war and you're only allowed to align yourself with one group, would the biker gangs be the number one, or would you like a different group of people on, having your back?
So it's just any group of people, or is it, like, gang-specific?
Well, it doesn't have to be gang-specific, just anyone that's not affiliated with, let's say, military. So would you rather have, well, I guess you could put gangs in there. Would you rather have a gang, or would you rather have, like, ninjas, you know, I think the biker gangs would be a pretty good pick.
What about
for
the
that.
Vagnar group?
I don't know that one. Is that a Illuminati style thing I don't know about? Are you part of a group I don't know?
No, I'm not. I'm just part of Odyssey St. Louis.
Okay, what is the so that's the gang that you're part of?
And your Odyssey.
What's this thing you said? The Vanguards? What did you say?
The Vagnar group. Well, it's like Vagnar. It's a W, but they pronounce it Vagnar.
Okay, and what is it?
That's like, basically, I think they were doing some fighting in Ukraine for Russia, and then they have just, like, international ties. They're basically...
They're mercenaries.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a pretty good one. All right, well, I'm glad to know. I would like to think that I would not be on any side. I would remove myself from it immediately.
You can ask me and then not answer the question.
I would go with, Samurai Warriors are pretty cool, I guess.
Okay.
We'll go with that. Or I would want to command animals. Like, there's some superheroes that do that. I would they would have to be useful outside of water.
Okay.
So, you know, I want, like, a bunch of lions and stuff, like, and elephants there, to like Dr. Doolittle.
Okay.
I want the Dr. Doolittle crowd. Just real quick, I know we're running out of time and we're talking nonsensical stuff anyway. Joining us after the break is a former Disney star. She was the voice of Kim Possible. She was also on Even Stevens. Yep. Shia LaBeouf was the other main lead actor of that one. So well known in that community. And I got to tell you, Christy Carlson Romano is going to be on a Fox reality show that starts next week called Special Forces, and people are pumped for the new season. So we're going to talk to her about her experience on that coming up after the news here at 2 o'clock. And Fox News Radio's Jared Halpern will have President Biden's year-end review. We'll discuss that with him. All right, real quick, I saw this one post online. It was a commentary about revising jobs. And he has a main concern about what's going to be happening at the start of the Trump administration is that they're going to fine the Philly Fed in particular, are going to miraculously start to revise all the job growth that, quote unquote, happened during the Biden administration. And he's pointing this out because he's saying that what they're essentially doing now, that Biden is out, Democrats have lost, now they're coming clean that their government statistics were not clean. Can we play clip number 6?
Now that the election is over, Joe Biden's minions are letting the terrifying economic data out of his statistical gimp box. Last week, the Philly Fed flagged yet another massive jobs revision, estimating in a new study that jobs actually fell in Q2 of this year, so that's April to June. That contrasts with official numbers claiming 653,000 jobs were created in those very same 3 months. In other words, we could be looking at another massive revision, possibly 700,000 in fake jobs brought to you by the finest statisticians government money can buy. Note, this is on top of the BLS revision last August that erased 818,000 imaginary jobs between March of 23 and March of this year.
Wow. Could you imagine that? So what we're talking about now going into the next year is that they're going to go back and revise these jobs and these statistics that they use to try to tout, oh, things are just so great under Joe Biden. Look at all the jobs that we have. The economy has never been better. People are earning more money. There's no reason to complain about inflation because everyone's so rich right now. And they use this lie in order to try to pump up the appearance that Joe Biden was doing a good job. But now they're going back after the fact and they're revising what they're saying. A 1.5 million jobs could be revised down as they continue to go back and look at this. 653,000 fake jobs that were added in order to try to pad the stats. You know how damaging that is? And his argument is that they're only doing this because they're trying to set up a way to blame Donald Trump for being responsible for it as they start to trend downwards again to make up for what Joe Biden did. Wow. All right. When we come back, we're going to talk to Christy Carlson Romano. She's on a new reality show, Fox News Special Forces, after the break. I'm Ryan Recker, filling in 97.1 FM Talk.